how are you?
Good.
You are taking Sandy's place?
Today.
Call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this May 15th. We have a bunch of VIP celebrity guests today, so I'm going to try and accommodate them by opening up two public hearings. A public hearing on Senate Bill 934, a public hearing on Senate Bill 1025, and let our witnesses sort out who has the most urgent business somewhere else.
Well, he and I are both missing the same committee, so.
All right, well, then let's do
1025.
That committee.
Number two and three on the
let's
list.
Let's start with whichever. You can have 1025 or.
Why don't we start with
934?
That's what 934?
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine.
We're on the other one.
Do you want Oliver to say anything or you want me to start?
Well, what do we have in these two bills, Mr. Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 934, brought to you by Senator Hayward and Representative Buehler. The bill establishes spending targets for commercial Medicaid insurers that compels insurers to expend a portion of total Medicaid spending on primary care. We have no amendments. Fiscal impact statements issued is on hold list, no revenue impact, and there's also testimony on hold list.
And 1025.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 1025, brought to you by Senator Manning, Knope, and Prozanski, and Representative Barker. The bill allows public safety officials to compel testing of persons for HIV or hepatitis B or C when an official is exposed to persons' bodily fluids in the course of official duties. Create similar process for specified law enforcement officials, correctional officials, healthcare providers, and firefighters to petition court for order compelling testing a broader category of communicable diseases.
Please remember to introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senate from the Honorable Representative Green Lakes District, Northwest Portland and Beaverton. And I'm honored to bring to you today, along with Representative Buehler, Senate Bill 934, to increase spending in both commercial insurance plans and Medicaid to at least 12% of premium. We know that when we invest upfront, when prevention and early detection and chronic disease management, that we save money. We also know that historically spending on primary care has been a very small percentage of total premium. We've been studying this thanks to Senate Bill 231 for the past couple of years, and we see a wide range of percent spend over the range of CCOs and commercial insurers. This bill is a very simple bill. It gives commercial insurers and Medicaid and CCOs a multiplicity of options of ways that they can increase their spend on primary care to a total of 12% of premium over the next 5 years. And it lets them use a range of alternative payment methodologies, including Comprehensive Primary Care Plus, which many of them are already participating in, other alternative payment methodologies. It requires them to extend, if they are participating in CPC Plus, it requires them to extend those additional payments on top of fee-for-service to practices that would not otherwise be eligible for CPC Plus. Federally qualified health centers, since they get cost-based reimbursement, pediatric practices, since they don't do geriatrics, and it's really based on Medicare, and other practices like those, some of our rural qualified health centers, do not get those supplemental payments, and they need them just as much as practices serving elderly patients in a more traditional setting. Really important to make sure that all of our practices are able to provide the wraparound services that are part of a comprehensive patient-centered primary care home. We know that the patient-centered primary care home program has saved Oregon millions and millions of dollars. Portland State University published a study last fall that showed over the course of the first 3 years of the PCPCH program, Oregon saved $240 million in Medicaid costs, which is a pretty remarkable sum of money, and that those savings went up year over year. Over the course of the 3 years, it was an average of $13 for every dollar invested, but in fact, it was more like $8 in the first year and $25 in the third. So the longer these programs are in place, the more established they are in a practice, the more effective they are. And by providing these additional payments, by increasing spend on primary care, we can provide on-site behavioral health. We can provide on-site nutrition. We can provide on-site group classes that help people manage their diseases better, that help address social determinants of health, that make it so difficult for people to either prevent illness or manage them in the long term. And this bill passed unanimously out of the Senate, and I hope it will out of the House as well. And I look forward to answering any of your questions.
You want to open on 25 as well?
Is that all right with you, gentlemen? All right. Thank you very much. I'm also privileged to, again, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator from District 17. I'm also privileged to be here to testify on 1025. You will remember that you heard testimony and then passed out of this committee, or are considering passing soon out of this committee, another Senate bill that addressed this issue for DOC corrections officers. They are exposed in the line of duty to body fluids in a variety of ways, unfortunately, and sometimes, as a result, have to take expensive and somewhat toxic medications as prophylaxis against HIV or hepatitis. And it's really important that they have the knowledge, their physicians, more importantly, have the knowledge that they need to treat people appropriately. And so when that bill came forward, I asked Senator Hansel whether we could include, in the Senate, I asked Senator Hansel whether we should be including our county corrections people and our frontline public safety officers, our police officers, and our sheriff's deputies. And he agreed, bill didn't have the right relating clause. So fortunately, Senator Manning was willing to work on getting that done, and that's the result of the bill you have in front of you. I have heard that there are some concerns about whether this bill and the other one on based on county on DOC should be narrowed to only include blood as opposed to any other blood-tinged other body fluids as opposed to any body fluids. I understand the concerns, and I recognize, as I said when I testified on that bill, that the probability of transmission in any of these other ways is very low. But we do know that there is a possibility, and it really, the chances are good that the decision will be made to not treat in those cases. But I think it's really important to have the knowledge to reassure our frontline officers that they're not at risk of contracting these diseases. I don't think it's an unreasonable violation of the adults in custody's medical privacy to release this information from physician to physician, healthcare provider to healthcare provider, solely for purposes of determining whether the public safety officer, whether a DOC officer, a county corrections person, sheriff's deputy, or police officer is at risk. And I think it's important to provide that protection for them overall. So I would urge you to not consider the amendment that has been proposed for that bill, and I would urge you not to amend this one either. Happy to take any questions before.
Does this one use the same model of asking a physician?
Yes. If they're essentially
identical. The bill that's written says the physician may give that information. It doesn't say they shall give it.
This one is, or that other one is?
The other one I know is. I haven't checked this one. It specifically says.
I thought we changed it to, well, I don't remember, Mr. Chair, but I think the permissive language is better than the require language, because it may be that the officer decides it's not necessary, right? He or she may decide that it's not necessary because the exposure wasn't significant enough. They're not concerned. It didn't hit broken skin, anything like that. And they may choose not to even worry about it. So requiring disclosure under those circumstances when there's been any exposure at all does seem like an unnecessary violation of their privacy.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff Barker, State Representative from House District 28, Beaverton, Iowa. This bill is to protect the officers, frontline public safety, first responders. If I think I've been exposed, I have to go to the court and present probable cause why I believe I have received toxic fluids from somebody else. And then the judge can compel testing if necessary. It was expanded. It used to just be HIV, hepatitis B and C. Now it covers any disease that might be like that. It could cause severe disability, significant. Let's see where I'm here. Any communicable diseases that may result in illness, death, or severe disability. One of the main things is so I can go home and know, get that checked very quickly and know that I'm okay. I don't have to worry about transmitting something to my wife or my kids. And that's very important to the public safety officers that are out there working. This bill also maintains the confidentiality of the test and prohibits the subsequent use of test material in civil or criminal cases. So this is just a medical bill just to tell somebody that they're medically safe or not, and then they can get treatment if it's needed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is James Ivory Manning, Jr. I'm the senator from Senate District 7, which is Eugene, Junction City. As the carrier of this bill on the Senate floor, I'm here today in support of SB 1025A. And this bill was introduced at the request of the Oregon Council of Police Association, Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. In addition, these groups work with OCDLA and ACLU to provide the final bill before you today. One of the things I like to talk about is mentioned from my personal experience as a young corrections officer. I recall one day I was walking on the walks, which is inside of the cell houses, and doing a normal routine check, I reached up on the slideway of between the bars and the guideway, and I felt an object that fell out and punctured me in the arm. I was able then to go. It was a shank. We reported it, and I was taken to the infirmary at the prison, and I was given the tetanus shot. So it happened right away. As a police officer, a former police officer, when I was out walking the beat, I encountered many instances where there are disruptions and disputes that turn physical altercations. Many times I would find myself in the middle of these altercations trying to separate people. While I never received any cuts or abrasions or anything like that, I am aware of a number of officers that have engaged in these disputes and walked away with a certain amount of damage, cuts, abrasions, things of this nature. When you are out and you are dealing with people that are intravenous drug users or may hepatitis C and D, all these things have been propped up, you have no idea what the effect is going to be on you, much less when you go home and talk to your family members. What is that going to look like? This bill offers one thing simply. It requires offers a chance for any officer, regardless of the profession, whether it's in corrections, police, EMT, or any others that come in contact with someone that may have a communicable disease, in order to get tested as quick as possible. Another thing that this bill does do is that this bill also includes safeguards to ensure that an individual's privacy interest is upheld. The test results are confidential and exempt from public record law and may be disclosed only to the practitioner designated physical physician or nurse practitioner, Oregon Health Authority, and source person. This also allows the person, the perpetrator that has inflicted the wound or caused the injury or the transfer of any kind of communicable fluids to be compelled to be tested to confirm. This is not unreasonable when you look at how a person that is involved in such work as a law enforcement or anyone that's in corrections, EMT, that's out trying to do the right thing. With that, I encourage you and I urge that you really look at this bill as something that's going to be geared towards helping our first responders get the immediate help that they need, and so that they're not worried about when they go home whether or not they are transferring something to one of their loved ones. So I urge your eye vote on this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I add one other quick comment?
Sure.
Thank you so much. Senator Manning's testimony reminded me of one other concern I had with the proposed amendment for the other bill, and that I assume you might end up considering for this one as well. The amendment states that it only would apply if there was broken skin on the corrections officer. And as it happened, yesterday I was talking with a colleague who's a general surgeon about a case of streptococcal lymphangitis, which is basically an acute streptococcal infection of lymph nodes in the armpit. And it must have come about through her child had streptococcal pharyngitis, strep throat, that we all know about. And she must have picked it up from him, but it went in her arm in an invisible cut. right? It could have been a nick from a razor. It could have been the tiniest of scratches. And it can be really tough to see those. And we know that bacteria and viruses are incredibly sneaky at getting in through small spaces. So I really appreciate the concern. I do agree that the risk is certainly increased if there's obvious skin disruption in the person who's been affected by the had the fluids on them. But sometimes viruses and bacteria are sneakier than we are, and they find the spaces we can't.
Are there any questions in the panel on either of the bills? Yes, Representative Kenny Dyer.
Thank you, Chair. I wanted to ask you in terms of Senate Bill...
Excuse me just a moment. Dr. Paulson, are you on now?
Yes, I am.
Okay, we'll get to you in a bit. I know you have a time limitation. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Is he going to address 1025, Senate Bill 1025?
No, 934.
So I just wanted to ask, we had testimony, you may have also, from Cascade AIDS program about the desire to make sure that it aligns with the CDC definition of how transmission can happen. Certainly it can be a teeny little cut, but it doesn't happen through saliva. The bill says it comes into contact with blood, bodily fluid, or potentially infectious material of another person. The CDC definition as of December 21st, 2016 says contact between broken skin, wounds, or mucous membranes and HIV-infected blood or blood-contaminated body fluids. So that's where the call to us that we heard last time around was to limit it to just blood or blood-infected bodily fluids. Just to be clear that it's not spitting, so I want to make sure that our laws align with the scientific data, but also we want to be very careful to not continue to stigmatize. I have no problem at all with the information being shared. I very, very, very much support this bill, but it makes it very clear here that deep open mouth kissing, if both partners have sores or bleeding gums and blood from the HIV-positive partner gets into the bloodstream of the HIV-negative partner, HIV is not spread through saliva. So any kind of blood or blood contaminated would be a reason, but not saliva.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, thank you for that question. I understand and I've read those guidelines and appreciate them, and we do know that most of the time the risk of transmission is exceedingly low, thank goodness. It's harder to transmit than we first feared back in the 80s when this was starting and I was in med school. But the bill addresses other communicable diseases in addition to HIV, which we know are transmitted through saliva, through urine, through feces. We have learned recently, for example, that Zika virus is transmitted through all of those fluids. And while this isn't the specific intention of the focus of this bill, were that to be the case, we could have a female corrections officer who was on duty and was put into contact with, you know, we will get Zika virus up here, folks. We will get CMV. We do have CMV. There are a lot of other viruses that can be relevant and are transmitted.
Let's try and hold us to the bills we have.
Well, that's what I'm saying is that I'm just saying that I appreciate Representative Kenny Geyer's concerns, but the bill addresses more diseases than just HIV. That's
I appreciate
all.
That was very helpful. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Are there any other questions in the panel? Well, thank you very much.
Just one comment?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee.
We've got more witnesses coming.
Okay, so I'll be very, very brief, but as a dentist for a healthcare professional, I agree with the saliva. I'm being serious about this. In the absence of periodontal disease, but in saliva where there is active periodontal disease, that saliva has blood mixed in with it. I mean, all the time.
Yep.
And that would be a blood contaminated fluid.
Yes, from the gums, persistent bleeding, and so I think it's a stretch to say that saliva is not going to have blood component to it. And I would be concerned about that.
I agree with you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you all very much. Dr. Paulson, we've opened two hearings at the same time. You're testifying on Senate Bill 934A, I believe.
Yes, I am.
Why don't you go ahead and give your testimony, and then we'll call the rest of the witnesses on that.
All right. Thank you very much. Chair Greenleaf, members of the committee, and for the record, my name is Dan Paulson, and I am in full support of Senate Bill 934. I'm a family physician in Springfield, Oregon, and an owner of the Springfield Family Physicians, a state-recognized patient-centered primary care home. I'm also the current president of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians. I've been a family doctor in Springfield for more than 15 years, and I love my job. We now have more tools than ever to care for our patients thanks to the multi-payer pilot program called the Comprehensive Primary Care Initiative. This program paid us for quality of care and not just for quantity of care. His initial pilot program, which ended at the end of 2016, however, Medicare determined that the CPC program was so successful in improving the health of patients and controlling costs that they have expanded it across the country. They have a new five-year program that they're calling CPC Plus, and that began in January 2017, and my clinic continues to participate in that. Through this CPC program, we receive per member per month payments for all of our enrolled patients, and we also have an opportunity to earn bonus payments if we meet certain quality measures. Because of these payments, I can offer a frail elderly woman the extra care that she needs to be able to return to her home after a hospital stay. I can provide some home visits to a new mom whose baby's health is too vulnerable to come into the clinic, and I'm able to connect a suicidal teenager with a mental health provider who works right in my office. Through the CPC payments, we were able to hire a nurse who does home visits. We have in-house mental health experts, and we have a hospital discharge planner who helps my patients get the follow-up care that they need. This infrastructure is only possible because of the CPC program and the incentive payments that it provides for us. Unfortunately, not all of the patient-centered primary care home clinics qualify for the program. Rural health centers, federally qualified health centers, and pediatric clinics are not eligible to participate in CPC. Also, less than half of my clinic's patients are enrolled in participating plans, even though we extend those added services to everyone. Senate Bill 934 seeks to address some of these issues by requiring that the alternative payment methodologies, like those offered by CPC Plus payers, be offered to all recognized primary center primary care home clinics. Additionally, it requires that all commercial insurers, CCOs, OEB, and PEB invest equally in primary care infrastructure, ensuring that patients statewide receive the services we know will improve health care and lower costs. For these reasons, I hope that you will join me in supporting Senate Bill 934. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Paulson. Are there any questions? Thank you very much for saving some time for us. We'll move on to the next witnesses.
Thank you.
You're welcome to stay on if you want or to leave if you want.
I'll go back to seeing my patients.
Good choice.
Imagine that.
Let's get to I think we have three more.
Yeah. Don Creech, Laura Etherden, and Jessica Addison.
I went first last time.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Dawn Creech. I'm here on behalf of the Children's Health Alliance, which includes more than 100 private practice pediatricians in the Portland metro area in Salem. Our providers care for approximately 140,000 children and their families, which, like Dr. Paulson, is why they can't be here today. However, I can tell you that every single one of them support Senate Bill 934. Over the last 13 years of my career, I've had the opportunity to work with well over 100 primary care clinics across Oregon and across the country. And what really is striking to me is that every single one of them really wants to provide the best possible care to their patients and families, and that's despite sometimes the financial disincentives to do so. Every time primary care practices do the right thing by hiring care coordinators, behavioral health clinicians, nutritionists, or staying open late on evenings and weekends, other parts of the healthcare system benefit. In Oregon, we've seen reduced ER visits and hospitalizations and fewer visits to specialists. In fact, as you heard from Senator Steiner Hayward earlier today, Portland State University researchers found that primary care practices in Oregon saved an estimated $240 million over just 3 years of the program. They found that for every $1 invested in primary care resulted in $13 in savings in other services.
Did they point out how we harvested that $240 million? I don't remember that coming out of the budget anywhere. What happened to that $240 million in savings?
Chair Ginlick, that's an excellent question. I think that they calculated savings in other parts of the healthcare system, like reduced ER visits and things like that. But I'm happy to forward on the details of this study if you'd like more information.
But if there were savings of that magnitude, then we should have spent $240 million less somewhere. I hadn't heard that we had. The interesting question.
That's right. Thank you. I believe the evidence is pretty clear. A strong primary care infrastructure benefits the entire healthcare system. But yet now we know here in Oregon that approximately 90% of our medical expenditures are on sick care in hospitals and from specialists. And that excludes the cost of pharmaceuticals. And I just keep thinking to myself, how are we ever going to transform our healthcare system if we're directing nearly 90% of our resources to patients once they are already sick? In pediatrics, we have a unique opportunity for preventive care with nearly every patient and family in Oregon. We can impact the lifelong trajectory of children and at the same time provide support to an education for their families. And we know that these impacts go well beyond the healthcare system, making sure children are kindergarten ready and equipped to be productive citizens. However, team-based care and transforming clinics takes considerable investment, often with little or no return to the physician practices that are shouldering the costs of those investments. So now is the time, through Senate Bill 934, to move our healthcare dollars upstream so that we can focus on prevention instead of paying so heavily for sick care. We also know that there's significant variation in Oregon in how much insurers are dedicating to primary care services. Some are doing the right thing, while others are not contributing their fair share in supporting the primary care infrastructure. I have been fortunate enough to participate over the last year in the primary care payment reform collaborative that was established through Senate Bill 231 in 2015. Prominent insurers and provider groups sat around the table and had really meaningful dialogue about what was needed to support primary care in Oregon. All of the participants agreed that Oregon needs increased investment in primary care and that all insurers should contribute their fair share. And I can tell you that these conversations were not easy. And I think it was a huge accomplishment to come to this agreement, both between providers and insurers sitting around the table having the conversation. So on behalf of more than 100 pediatricians in the Children's Health Alliance, we strongly support Senate Bill 934, which will truly help move our health care dollars upstream and prevent costly sick care, ultimately giving providers the resources they need to take the best possible care of Oregon's children and families. Thank you for this opportunity, and I'd be happy to answer any additional questions.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs Hayden and Nose, and members of the Healthcare Committee. My name is Laura Etherton. I'm the Policy Director at the Oregon Primary Care Association. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony in support of Senate Bill 934. OPCA represents Oregon's 32 community health centers, also known as federally qualified health centers. Community health centers deliver integrated primary care, including dental and behavioral health services, to over 420,000 Oregonians. And with a focus on vulnerable populations, health centers are central to coordinated care organizations, networks, and serve one in four patients who are on the Oregon Health Plan. We support Senate Bill 934 to increase investment in primary care and align payment to support patient-centered primary care homes and emerging models of advanced care. The bill moves forward the work of the work and recommendations of the Primary Care Payment Collaborative, which OPCA and several of our member health centers participate in. And we represent the work of Representative Bueller and Senator Steiner Hayward as sponsors of this bill and the members of and staff of the collaborative for all their hard work on to move this forward. Community health centers have been part of the journey to transform payment and care for over 10 years. This work began with the patient-centered primary care homes work years ago, and more recently in the last 5 years, OPCA has been engaged in intensive work with OHA on developing and implementing an alternative payment methodology for community health centers at rural health clinics. This is now in place at 13 health centers and one rural health clinic, and ideally this is supporting care that goes not only to coordinating care well, but also addressing the social determinants of health, which we recognize as being more and more important all the time. We appreciate the work that the collaborative did to bring forward these recommendations and to use the CPC Plus payment methodology as a framework to align payment in Oregon and move us forward. Of course, I think the collaborative acknowledged, as many of us did, there are some shortcomings to the CPC Plus piece, partly because it's only available to some part of providers. And so that means pediatric practices, rural health clinics, community health centers, and some others were not able to participate, even if they're, you know, active participants in the care transformation work. And also because CPC is a national model designed for a subset of providers and patient populations, it may not necessarily line up exactly with where Oregon is going. So I think with this bill and with the work of the collaborative moving forward, we see an opportunity to really move forward with a program that's working well, but also allow it some flexibility to adjust to specific patient populations and to Oregon's health transformation. So once again, offer appreciation for the work of all those involved to move this forward, and urge your support for Senate Bill 934. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. We support Senate Bill 934A and the great work that it will enable the state to undertake. We are in Providence Health Plan, a major supporter and player in the CPC Plus methodology. In addition, we have 54 PCPCHs, patient-centered primary care homes throughout the state. And so we are pleased. We're early supporters of Senate Bill 231 and been involved in the collaborative and engaged as this bill has made its way through the process. As we sit here in the House and this body undertakes its deliberation of this bill, we would recommend four additions which we believe will improve this bill and make it easier to implement. And so those four changes, first, to the way that the bill is designed, requires for the regulated commercial market to measure the primary care spend off of the premium. And while this may be appropriate for small group and even large group, for the individual market where there is a fair amount of remaining instability in rates and we see a higher administrative cost to administer that population than in the small group or other markets, we are respectfully requesting that the methodology be based off of claims in the individual market as a more stable measure of what the appropriate level of spend should be for that population. That is going to be more stable and take out that administrative cost, again, which is higher in that population, and retain more stability across a book of business for an entity, frankly, like Providence, that has a very large proportion of its business in the individual market. When there are swings in premiums due to factors which are largely beyond our control, those costs then drive up across our book of business where we would need to be on primary care spend. That makes it more difficult and less attractive to be in that book of business, frankly, and at a time where that is not a popular market, we would encourage this body not to do more to make that less attractive. We believe that this is a small piece that could be helpful there, while not backing away from the desire to make sure that there's an adequate spend in primary care. In addition, We would encourage in the definition of premium to remove premium tax and other assessments on insurers, those are, that are put over the top of the premium in order to fund worthy programs. This legislature will be considering a premium tax as part of a Medicaid budget and a desire to create a reinsurance pool, one that, by the way, Providence supports, but that, to put that on the record while I'm here, to confirm it here, just in front of everybody, we support that. But that that tax ought not to add to the percentage of premium as it relates to what the demand in this bill is. That we ought to be
clear. Goes to claims, then it doesn't matter.
It, in the individual market, but the overall for the large group and small group market and the way that the bill is written today, it would be measured off of premium.
Do you have some amendments ready?
We have concepts that we are working with the bill's sponsor, but we just wanted to put on the record that there are some concerns, and we want to work to try and reach agreement. In addition, we'd like to see the methodology published before the year starts and not changed during the year, so that we can make sure that we can meet that, and we aren't dealing with shifting requirements, and that we just as pharmaceutical out-of-pocket pharmaceuticals aren't counted in the measurement. That we don't count medical benefit pharmaceuticals, which can be quite costly in the spend. So we're happy to continue to work on these and get to an agreement with folks. We think this is a great bill.
I'd like to ask you a question. I serve on the PEB board as the legislator's representative. And if this issue is going to be involved in the PEB board, how is Providence as a third-party administrator going to affect the ability to move from maybe 7%, I think, now to 12%. How will that come about?
So we have gone back. The PEB board is based upon total expenditure as opposed to percent of premium. Our recalculations on PEB spend show that we're closer to 11% on primary care, not at 7. Yeah, those early numbers that were reported, I talked to my medical director for Providence Health Plan this morning. He said that the recalculation shows that we're closer to 11. I mean, frankly, the adjustment over time for all plans, I mean, there is the pie is already spent in healthcare spend when you have an insurance premium product. So what you're looking at is how do you renegotiate contracts with specialists and others to try and drive more money into primary care that will have downstream effects. And in some areas in the state, that is significantly harder than others. So this will be a challenge, one that we are ready to take on, but we want to make sure that we take these steps forward, that we're walking and make sure that we're doing that appropriately before we try and run.
So we'll expect some amendments from you, we hope, with the blessings of the sponsors. That would be nice.
That's
a good question.
Chair Greenlick, I just wondered if we could have the opportunity of the other two people testifying and maybe Representative Bueller, who's a sponsor of the bill, to respond to any of the suggestions that Providence offered.
Well, I assume you were suggesting that it goes to the sponsors of the bill.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, we have been talking with Senator Steiner Hayward, so I have not had a chance to fully vet these with other advocacy groups or with Representative Bueller.
Okay, good. No other questions? Thank you very much. We'll hear back from you.
Yes, we'll do.
We will close the public hearing. Senate Bill 934 and continue the public hearing we opened on Senate Bill 1025. Mr. Jaffer, would you call the next group, please?
We have Amanda Dalton, Sheriff Pat Garrett, and Chief John Teague.
I think that's it, isn't it?
Yes.
I'm going to go ahead and start. Keep us moving.
Go for
That's
it.
Okay. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, Amanda Dalton. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Council of Police Associations, and we represent about 60 small and medium-sized police unions across the state. here in support of Senate Bill 1025. And I wanted to just walk through some of the details. You heard a lot of this from our Senate and House sponsors. I do want you to know that the bill was heavily worked on the Senate judiciary side with ACLU and OCDLA, and I do have their permission today to share with you that their concerns have been addressed and that they're both neutral on the bill before you. We also have support from the Oregon State Ambulance Association. I want to point out that this bill is slightly different than the corrections bill that's before you later today, in that that bill does not require permission from the individual, and keep in mind that those are inmates in custody. This bill actually addresses individuals out of custody. There's not necessarily a crime even pending or charged. And what we've done is just gone in and modified existing law. So we actually believe that the modernization to the HIV and Hep B and C is actually a good thing. Broadening that to all communicable diseases kind of gets us away from the stigma of these original laws when it was just the two. And so I just point that out for you, that this does require an ex parte hearing. That's existing law. What we did, though, is we had heard from some of our officers on the ground, and you'll hear some specifics from the chief and sheriff next to me. That there were delay concerns, there was timing concerns, and that there was also a probable cause threshold concern. So prior existing law required them to show that the petitioner had been exposed to bodily fluids of another, and that a significant possibility existed that the petitioner had been exposed. So it was almost like showing you that the blood I had been infected with was infected. And so it was almost this double negative, and it made the standard very difficult. And so what you see before you is a negotiated probable cause threshold that we worked very closely with OCDA on that now requires exposure to bodily fluids that constitute, one, a significant exposure, which is a defined term that we copied from California, and two, that is capable of transmitting as a disease. So we're not disclosing records that aren't pertinent to kind of life and safety of the officer or the first responder. We also went in and made changes to the petition that the officer is required to show to the court to establish that probable cause. Two important changes I thought that we made on the Senate side with OCDLA and ACLU were, one, a requirement that the law enforcement officer make a good faith attempt to get consent from the individual, so that our first step is not necessarily just to go straight to court, but rather to get voluntarily consent. We heard from some of our officers on the Senate side that a lot of times an individual will use this against the officer, and so not provide that consent almost intentionally, so to kind of punish the officer after intentionally exposing them to bodily fluids. And so this is an important step. There was also a request on the Senate side to require a doctor's note why they believe that the transmission could result in a disease. Our compromise there was to provide the doctor's note if the doctor is accessible. So if the exposure happens on a Friday night and we can't find a doctor, the individual will have to include in the petition to the court why they couldn't find a doctor. And so that's something that the judge would completely consider. I do want to point out, just because you are the healthcare committee and not the judiciary committee, that there are certain privacy protections in this. There is a limitation on the blood draw. The blood cannot be used for any investigative purposes, and it's retained only as long as necessary to confirm results. And also that they are confidential. They're exempt from the public records law. And that we do, and I think these are some of the changes you're seeing on the corrections bill. Our bill does require disclosure specifically to medical provider to medical provider. And with that, I'll let the officer share some of the specific examples.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, committee members. I am Washington County Sheriff Pat Garrett, and this year's president of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Sheriffs across Oregon stand alongside the Oregon Council of Police Associations and the Oregon Associations of Chiefs of Police in support of Senate Bill 1025, which will help protect the health of law enforcement professionals following contact with bodily fluid of another person or other fluids while performing their essential job duties. Currently, law enforcement agencies face some delays in receiving test results for potentially life-threatening diseases and medical conditions of individuals who are in their custody. The proposed amendments to ORS 433.085 will ensure test results are shared with law enforcement agencies in a timely manner, provider to provider, as you just heard. They will also expand the testing to include all communicable diseases, not just HIV and hepatitis B or C. And on that front, I just want to recognize that while this includes police officers, it also includes our wonderful emergency medical service providers, our fire service providers, and staff that work in jails and prisons. And someone who runs a jail We're very aware of the risk, as we have inmates who unfortunately are affected with tuberculosis. So tuberculosis is a very real threat posed by such kind of fluid exchanges, and it's not out of the realm of possibilities at all for there to be polio, malaria, and measles among the folks that we have the responsibility to maintain safe and secure custody. I can tell you that we certainly support the requirement to ask for consent first. I mean, we have no problem whatsoever asking for consent. That's the current way that we do it today. And we also very much respect the requirements that this be confidential. In my 28 years, occasionally, every few months, one of these cases comes up, either on the jail side or the enforcement side at our office. And confidentiality has always been a very, very important part of this process for us. It's never been something that's escaped or leaked out. We all understand the importance of maintaining confidentiality. I can tell you from talking with our staff, individuals who, as through the course of their duties, have either been pricked by a needle, bitten by somebody, or just in the course of trying to gain control of somebody, they're scuffed, they're bleeding, the other person is scuffed and bleeding, or whether you're just trying to take custody of somebody, and it can go absolutely calm in the way you want it until they turn and spit in your face. And those kinds of contaminations cause anxiety that can be almost debilitating to individual public safety officers. And once those test results are shared and they have a pretty good sense for really the reality of their future, in almost all cases, the news is good. But having that good news is an enormous peace of mind for not only them, but their entire family. So I just encourage you to support the A.N. Gross Senate Bill 1025, and thank you for allowing me a few minutes today.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is John Teague. I'm the Chief of Police in the City of Kaiser Police Department. I'm the President of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I'm here representing peace officers across the state.
You've come from the shortest distance.
Yes, sir. I can speak at length on this House bill and the underlying statute 433085, but I disciplined myself to reduce it to writing, so I'll take just 2 minutes and 5 seconds of your time. It seems like this bill has wide support, but if that support's wavering, then I want to encourage you to pass it. Too often, peace officers are in contact with other persons' body fluids, whether that's because they wrestle with them, they're spat upon with blood-tainted saliva, I just added that, or are stuck with a needle. It used to be that IV drug users were careful about their needles, holding on to them. For too long, for whatever reason, we now find them in parks, along roadways, and scattered throughout users' homes and cars. It's those discarded needles that worry us the most. They're the ones that we often can't tie immediately to any particular person and don't have enough fluid to test. I had an officer in 2015 who was stuck with a needle quite deep. It drew blood, which means it also shared blood that was in the syringe. We used to call that a wash, from when users draw blood back into the syringe to wash the remaining narcotic, ensuring they get it all. Sometimes they sell the wash. We don't know why it was in that particular syringe, the one that stuck my officer, but thankfully there was enough to test. It tested positive for HIV, and he was treated appropriately. They couldn't test for Hep C, which required monitoring my officer for a year. Thankfully, he suffered no long-term effects, and thankfully we had the blood to test. My officer's experience, as nerve-wracking as it was for as long as it was, pales in comparison, however, to those times when an officer has no clue what he may have been exposed to. On the occasions when we don't have fluids to test, but we do have a known source, Senate Bill 1025 will mitigate much of the dilemma, including whether to engage in expensive and, frankly, debilitating prophylactic treatment. I want to encourage the committee to recall that first responders and licensed medical workers voluntarily put themselves in places where exposure is possible. And for some, that includes places where the public doesn't want to be at all. Surely Senate Bill 1025 is a reasonable accommodation for the risks, and I appreciate your colleagues' previous support of the bill and encourage your support as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions in this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1025. We're not going to work any of the three bills we're going to hear today, but it would be very useful if you all have a chance to look them over, and we'll carry them over till, I think, till Wednesday as a temporary thing. So we'll just carry them over till Wednesday. I also, we are not able to work either two of the three work session bills. We don't have the material we need. We've got some amendments coming and other things, so keep tuned. But I am going to open a work session on Senate Bill 856A. Mr. Duffer, what have you got on that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 856A, the bill received a public hearing last week in the committee. The measure allows naturopathic physicians to perform a number of activities medical doctors are currently authorized and licensed to perform in Oregon. Declares emergency effective on passage. There's no amendments. There's a minimal fiscal. No revenue statements are on the list. The bill passed out of the Senate with 25 yes votes and 4 no votes.
And I think the organizations had a chance to answer some questions, so I hope you're ready for a vote. Let's take a motion.
Chair Greenlick, I would like to move Senate Bill 856A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Notes moves Senate Bill 856A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Do you call the roll, please?
Representative Kinnegar.
Aye.
Representative Fuller.
Yes.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer. Aye. Representative Malmstrom.
Aye.
Representative Heck.
Aye. Vice
Chair Nose. Yes. Vice Chair
Hayden.
Yes.
Chair Greenlee.
Yes. Motion carries. Senate Bill 856 is on its way to the floor. Do we have a volunteer to carry it?
Representative
Malmstrom will carry it. Close the work session on Senate Bill 856. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 235. Mr. Minister, what have you got for us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 235A, it amends the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act by allowing use of tobacco products in the closed area that is outdoors. There's a dash A6 amendment on OLIS. There's a number of things. I'll just cover the high points. The amendment directs the Department of Revenue to establish a tobacco licensure program. The Department of Revenue would be granted the authority to revoke, suspend, or refuse, or issue or renew a tobacco retail license here in Oregon. Amendment grants the Department of Revenue the authority to impose civil penalties, and it grants the Oregon Health Authority the authority to inspect retail establishments that offer wholesale retail sale of tobacco products or inhalant delivery system. There's a no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact.
Is that the A6 amendment you're talking about?
Correct, Chair.
Okay, good. Would you call the first panel, please?
We have Jen Baker, Morgan Cowling, and Samantha Kahn.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Jen Baker on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association, here today in support of Senate Bill 235A with the dash 6 amendment. The dash 6 amendment is a policy that would create a tobacco retail licensure statewide program here in Oregon. We are one of a handful of states that lacks a statewide retail licensure program. And the short of it is that really means we don't have an effective and consistent way of enforcing tobacco control policies that you all pass here at the state legislature, like Tobacco 21, which will be on the House floor with bipartisan support later this week. We don't have anyone out in the field actually enforcing that in a meaningful way. Tobacco retail licensure would implement a program that would regulate the industry, and the ultimate goal of it is to protect children from accessing tobacco. The nurses care about this because tobacco remains the number one killer here in the state of Oregon, and it's no surprise, it's a big industry. We sell 150 million packs of cigarettes in a single year in Oregon, 21 million cans of moist stuff, and over $30 million of cheap cigars and $1.8 million of premium cigars. So it's a big industry, and in order to ensure that we're regulating it properly and keeping tobacco and nicotine products out of the hands of minors and preventing them from becoming lifelong users, a tobacco retail licensure system is vital.
Thanks. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlich, members of the committee. My name is Morgan Cowlingen, and I'm the executive director of the Coalition of Local Health Officials. I have the pleasure of representing the 34 local health, public health departments across Oregon who work every day to promote health and prevent the spread of disease. And Chloe would like to, that's the Coalition of Local Health Officials, Chloe, her acronym. Chloe would like to encourage you to support Senate Bill 235 with the A6 amendment to create a statewide licensure program, tobacco retail licensure program in Oregon. This bill comes to you as a product of the last 3 years' worth of discussions. Before I tell you about some of the aspects of the bill, I, too, want to tell you about the important need for this policy. In 2013, Oregon had a serious problem with youth being able to purchase tobacco and had the highest rate of retailers selling to youth in the country. That year, 22.5% of retailers surveyed through the SINAR program sold to children, 6 percentage points above the next state, which put us at risk for losing a federal block grant. And we can't be at risk for losing federal funds in this current and budget environment, so this is very important. Since 2013, the Oregon Health Authority and jurisdictions across Oregon have taken action in their own communities to reduce youth access to tobacco. In the last 3 years, we've seen Lane County and cities within Lane County and Multnomah County enact their own tobacco retail licenses with outreach and education and enforcement. Most recently, we just saw Klamath County also pass a tobacco retail licensure. In addition to that, the Oregon Health Authority has streamlined their SINAR and food and drug and FDA programs within the Public Health Division for better coordination within the state agency. While we've made some improvements, we know that we can and should be doing more for youth to prevent youth access to tobacco. Better coordination amongst the agencies already working to decrease youth consumption and a local community connection to work with retailers is needed. And that's what this bill does. It really, at its core, is a coordination bill between Department of Revenue, the Oregon Health Authority, and local jurisdictions who are all working on this. So I'd like to tell you about four important aspects of this bill, of the A6 amendment to create a statewide tobacco retail licensure. This is one license with coordination between the agencies issued by the Department of Revenue. The Department of Revenue's work to ensure tax compliance would benefit from an accurate list of who's selling tobacco in the state, both tobacco retailers and inhalant delivery systems, e-cigarette inhalant. I think I got it. said that incorrectly. Basically, e-cigarette retailers would also be included in this. Currently, DOR, the Oregon Health Authority, and local public health authorities all have a role in tobacco and e-cigarette prevention and enforcement. The A6 amendment would ensure OHA, DOR, and local public health authorities' connections should be seamless for the retailer and build off existing knowledge and expertise in local communities. So the second point is streamline enforcement. OHA has consolidated the SINAR and FDA and FDA programs, and the information sharing, which is written into the bill, so that DOR and local public health authorities and OHA and local public health authorities will share information, will help ensure that retailers would not be checked multiple times by multiple agencies. So really, that connection is so important. The third element is that this would create a self-sustaining program, and that the bill limits to fees to only cover the cost of the program and would allow the Department of Revenue and OHA and local public health authorities to set their own fees to cover their costs of running the program, their local program. And then this would allow for local enforcement. Local public health authorities are uniquely poised to conduct this community outreach and inspections on the ground across Oregon. Building on the knowledge and expertise and work in local communities, this bill would be a proactive preventative approach, especially with that outreach and education element as well. This bill connects the would also connect the DOR license to ordinances that would be passed in local communities, so there'd be that connection as well. Oregon has made great strides over the last 3 years to decrease youth consumption. However, we cannot lose sight of these goals or become compliant. We need to do more, and this bill is an important piece of that puzzle. Please support the A6 amendments and move this bill. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, my name is Samantha Kahn. I'm with Multnomah County Health Department, and I'm here today to very briefly express my support for the Dash 6A amendment in Senate Bill 235. So as you've heard, Multnomah County has a tobacco retail license program. We found this to be a very effective way to identify who the tobacco retailers are in our community and to work to educate and promote compliance with tobacco retail laws. We're very supportive of implementing a tobacco retail license program statewide. Oregon's one of just 9 states in the country that does not require retailers to have a license to sell tobacco. We support implementing this because it's a way to ensure that retailers have the tools and the information they need to keep tobacco out of the hands of young people. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions in this panel? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next panel, please.
A question of staff. Does this have a fiscal impact?
Representative Kinmer, sorry, the Dash A6, we do not have paperwork. I was referencing the A and Gross version. Thank you.
Excellent question.
I would assume it will have a fiscal and probably another fund.
Okay.
Got another question, Representative Hack.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. This is a very important issue. I'm a little bit confused. We started with enclosed smoking porches, and now we're on to licensure. So I haven't had a chance to go through everything, but I do have a couple of questions. In regards to the data collection, what will be done with the data? Who will house that data, and what will they do with it exactly?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hack, I think we've had conversations early on in thinking through how this would work. In those conversations, the Oregon Health Authority would need some way of tracking, and that information could be housed and be available to local communities and to the Department of Revenue to for each agency to use.
Can I have a follow-up?
Yeah.
It says that you'll establish a database or other mechanism for collecting information from local public health authorities and the general public regarding the regulation of retail sale of tobacco products. I'm trying to understand what that does to prevent the sale of, and I'm just struggling a little bit because I know that we've had several conversations with OHA, who is extremely overwhelmed with the work that we've already got them doing, and I'm just trying to understand how and what this would do to prevent.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hack, to your first comment, actually, Senate Bill 235 started as a retail licensure bill over in the Senate. Okay. It made its way over to you in what we think is an incomplete version, so we're hoping that you will help us out with that. As far as the data goes...
Looked at the little explanation, sorry. Yeah,
it's okay. As far as the data goes, the first thing is public health is really... the foundation of public health really is data. So we can't enforce tobacco retail licensure, or we can't force tobacco control policies unless we know who's selling it and where. And then we can also use that data to build better policies and figure out how we can do better moving forward.
Okay, can I have another?
Yes.
Just a couple more. It also says in Section 19 that you'll abolish the State Police Tobacco Law Enforcement Fund, and that those funds will then be transferred to the state treasurer for deposit into the general fund, and that those will go into general governmental purposes. What's the amount in that fund, and why would we abolish that?
Chair Greenlip, Representative Hack, I don't know the exact amount in the fund, but what the fund does right now is support a volunteer program. I mentioned earlier in my testimony that we don't have a consistent statewide way to enforce tobacco regulation. We do have a handful of retired state troopers who volunteer their time to do compliance checks, and they are
empowered to ticket retailers who are caught violating any tobacco control policies, but it's a volunteer program. I think the money is to sustain running it, but the folks who actually are on the ground in the field are volunteers, so it lends itself to inconsistency.
Okay, just that leads me to my final question. Thank you, Chair. So if we do have some other county, city enforcement that's happening, I don't see a preemption anywhere, and if I'm not seeing it, why is there not one here? Or if I'm not seeing it, can you guide me to it?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hack, the preemption that is included in this bill would preempt local municipalities from requiring a second license. So the Department of Revenue would be the holder for a single license. What we are not preempting in this bill is local communities from passing more progressive controls. So, for instance, Lane County right now has a policy that prohibits the sale of tobacco within 1,000 feet of schools. ONA thinks that's a great policy. It's not one that we think is really viable here in this building, but we want to make sure that local communities remain empowered to put policies like that in place, and that it's tied to their license.
I think we have six more witnesses.
Thank you. And actually, may I follow up and answer?
Very brief.
Chair Greenlake, Representative Hack. I don't believe that there is a preemption in the Dash A six amendments. It has been discussed. Preemption has been a big part of this conversation. And I think the goal with the Department of Revenue issuing a license was to move to one license. And the Coalition of Local Health Officials would be supportive of an amendment that for only one license, which would require communities that do have a license to do some additional work to restructure the additional protections that they have in their tobacco retail license. But we would be fine as long as those communities would still be able to do important time, place, manner ordinances to respond to the needs of their community.
You call the next panel, please.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have Sean Miller, Matt Minahan, and Richard Kosasen.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association, and we're here in opposition to the Dash 6 Amendment. And,
in support of the underlying bill.
The underlying bill addresses Mr. Perry's issues on smoking porches, which came out of the Senate. This similar language was stripped from the bill in the Senate committee.
I was just asking if, while you oppose the A6, you support the underlying
bill. We're neutral on the underlying bill. It's specifically the Dash A6s, which I'll comment today. And worked a lot on this bill, and I hate to come before you opposing statewide licensing, because I do not, and my organization does not. We've actually worked the last 3 years on trying to craft a statewide license, actually worked with Multnomah County on their license. I participated in that process. It was a good process, and I think some of the underlying components in this bill we can absolutely support. However, when the last panel says this is a product of the last 3 years, it is absolutely not a product. And that's what did not pass out of that Senate Healthcare Committee and those several provisions. Why? And I believe in 2 years ago, Senate Bill 1559 was a product that we supported, which was a statewide licensing. We actually worked very closely with Multnomah County and very closely with the advocates to try to craft that statewide proposal again, would have one license and allow for local enforcement if they wanted to. So I know Multnomah County and others wanted to have that local enforcement. There's several provisions I'll point out in here that we can agree with. However, we were not supportive of a patchwork approach where you have different you know, under this bill, public health authorities, where counties, cities actually having further regulations where we have to go through, and not only you may have one statewide license with one fee associated with all of them, but you're going to have several different qualifications requirements that you have to go through to get your license. And that's what we wanted to work out. That's what we tried to work out in 1559, which passed Ways and Means a couple of years ago, but didn't make it all the way through. And I do want to point out a lot of the problems. It starts on page 12 of the bill, Mr. Chair, lines 9, where it does allow for lines 5, local public health authorities may enforce pursuant to their ordinance enacted by the government body, you know, the standards for regulating the retail sales of tobacco. And it's in addition to the standards described in Section 5 of the bill. Section 5 of this section. And when we look at Section 5, I think a lot of those elements we were worked on in 1559, where the public health authority can have agreements with local governments for enforcement. I think Multnomah County wanted that authority. And then they wanted to, and if you look at lines 13 through 17 on page 13, basically says that the public health authority, the standards and processes established by the state law and rule to be consistent statewide. And I think those are the elements that we were trying to create when we try to negotiate a bill that both advocates the state and industry can support. So again, I'm here before you today, Mr. Chairman, saying that I'm more than happy to support a statewide license. I've been saying that for 3 years. I know we've been called in by many groups, including particularly on the Senate side and several work groups, and I've been consistent there. But this bill and this amendment, which did not have the votes in the original bill, is back before your committee, and can't support it. Happy to work on it further, because again, I'd love to get there on a statewide license, but this amendment doesn't do it. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to conclude. Thanks.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, my name is Matt Minahan. I represent EC Blend and select clients of the retail manufacturing industry of the vaping industry. I'm going to echo a little bit about what Mr. Miller said. I want to be clear in that we aren't opposed to a reasonable statewide licensure program. We too worked with some of the proponents of this bill in the past. We came close in the 2016 session. Unfortunately, we weren't able to reach a consensus. We feel the dash AA6 on this bill takes us in the wrong direction from that. We have a few issues of the bill. The no preemption allowing local authorities to implement their own rules. We have clients that have a number of locations in various counties, so we could have one location with a different fee and a different set of rules than the neighboring county where they have a second location. We feel that's unmanageable. We'd be more comfortable with a statewide, uniformed rules. The fees aren't defined. We'd be more comfortable with having the fees defined in statute. Right now, they'll have various fees, and some could be unreasonable. There's no matrix for violations. So I, too, served on the Multnomah County Board when they implemented their program with Sean, and we matrixed out the fees. So the way this is written, we could have one of my store owners takes a day off and goes to the coast, and God forbid the employee is frustrated or gets busy, and God forbid sells to a minor or puts the wrong product on the shelf. One violation could result in a non-renewal. So we would like to see further discussions and further work on matricing out the violations. Just the way this is, it's just unworkable for us, and we oppose, and we would be willing to sit down and see if we can attempt one more time to get there, because again, we're not opposed to a reasonable licensing fee. We just feel the dash A6 doesn't get us there. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Richard Kosasan with the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association, and we too would be opposed strenuously to the A6 amendments for a variety of reasons, but let me back up for just a brief moment. I think the previous panel, one individual wanted to bring up results from the SINAR report, and the SINAR report's been around for years and years and years, and basically the requirement under the SINAR amendment directs states to have on the books, on their books, laws that prohibit the sale of tobacco to anyone under the age of 18, to enforce such laws, and to report back to the federal agency. The number that was given was from 2013, and my goodness, the sky is falling. We're going to be jeopardizing our block grant dollars from the federal government. That was from 2013, perhaps. I would encourage the committee members to take a look at the last 2 year results of the SINAR report, and you would find that those numbers are substantially different. In fact, they're about 94, 95 compliant with issues associated with the sale of tobacco to minors. I think that was a little bit off target. But with the amendments, I would encourage the committee to take a look at the language contained lines 9 through 16 on page 12. Specifically, at the end of that paragraph, it states, in addition to standards described in paragraph A of this subsection, including qualifications for engaging in the retail sale of tobacco or inhalant delivery systems that are in addition to the qualifications described in Section 5 of this 2017 Act. In essence, what we would set up here is a bifurcation between the state licensing program and criteria that local governments may use to require retailers to abide by to access a license. As Matt just mentioned too, we have severe reservations with provisions contained in Section 7, the revocation, suspension, refusal to issue or renew. With the way this is written on its face, with one inadvertent sale to a minor, a retailer may indeed be faced with the potential revocation of his or her license. I think that's a little overly broad. I would encourage the committee to take a look at the Federal Tobacco Control Act from 2009. It's a very interesting act, granting the FDA control over tobacco. But in their program, they set out a matrix of penalties against retailers, and it's a rather prescriptive matrix. Scheduling down, but you get to a point where you have, if you have a bad actor in the state, and we would be the first to suggest those people should not be in the business, they should not be around, they should not continue, but you get to, under that federal act, you get to the point of a no sale order in terms of the federal government coming in and saying to the retailer, you're done, you're not going to sell tobacco any longer. These amendments, to me, should be coordinated with that. Mr. Chair, I could go on, but
I think your
Mr. Miller,
is clear.
Mr. Miller was clear. This basically reflects provisions contained in the underlying Senate Bill 235 that was considered in the Senate. We would be happy, again, to enter into some real discussions, but I would leave one thing, and that is, with that federal act, the FDA made dollars available to states for enforcement purposes. And subsequent to 2009, I believe, if the FDA webpage is accurate, Oregon in October of 2016 lost its contract and I understand that they're in the process of trying to get the contract back with FDA, but they lost their contract. And if you look at Oregon in comparison to other states that access federal dollars for enforcement purposes, Oregon's on the short end of the stick. You look at Oregon, I think it's about 1.2 million. Idaho is about 4 million. California's about 18 million. Washington State's about 8 million. Those dollars could go to effective enforcement. The last thing I would say, with your permission, Mr. Chair, we have oodles of laws on the books today, and we've had oodles of laws on the books today concerning minors, the sale, and tobacco-related issues. If we would focus on the education, promotion, and enforcement of those laws, we would all be far better off. Thank you for your patience, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions in the panel?
Yeah, I have one.
Go ahead.
I'd like to know if the gentleman in the middle has ever attempted to raise teenagers, because in spite of having laws and stuff on the books and doing all the education I can, it's not really working very well.
Mr. Chair, and to Representative
Knight, I don't think he requires an answer.
Oh, I would like to. I have had that pleasure. Most of the teenagers I've dealt with, especially some of the ones in my house, if you don't want them to do something within the next 24 hours, just make certain that you say the night before at the dinner table, there's one thing that I don't want you to ever try or ever do, and you've almost guaranteed they're going to engage in that behavior within about 24 hours.
I've done the best I can, obviously. Mr. Chair, but not good enough, apparently. Uh-huh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have any advice on teenagers. I've had the same challenges. But I do have a question about your statement about Oregon having lost its enforcement dollars. And I'm curious, two-part question, if you know why that is. And the other part of that question is that I remember a few years ago when we were talking about this, one of the reasons that the tobacco retail licensing has been promoted is that it helps us be more effective in those SINAR investigations, and that because we were ending up very close to the cutoff from the feds, they said if you go over 20% of the kids are they're caught selling to kids, you lose funding. I didn't know it was enforcement funding. I thought that was prevention dollar funding. But in any case, I remember that we were like at 19%, whereas states, and I think the example was North Carolina, that actually are, you know, grow tobacco, had a much lower rate of minors being caught. And so that was one of the arguments for retail licensing, is that there's so much more you can do. I've been reading a lot of the websites about tobacco retail licensing and the connection between that and time, place, and manner kind of strategies in reducing smoking among minors.
Mr. Chair, Kenny Geyer, Representative Kenny Geyer, excuse me.
Okay.
There's, a number of issues. One, we're mixing apples and oranges when we talk about the FDA enforcement dollars that have been really available subsequent to the Federal Act in 2009. That is one bucket of dollars that have been made available to states. The SINAR program, been around much longer, but basically the inducement there was, if a state was indeed facing a non-compliance rate of something over in excess of 20%, they could jeopardize indeed block grant funding. But to suggest that all states require a license and they're all similar, what's very interesting is many states require a minimal registration, a minimal license, and they license for purposes that we really don't need here in terms of tax compliance. And Oregon's tax system, the way it is built through licensed distributors, is very closed and I think very clean.
So I think that my statement was more in the fact that because we were so non-compliant, as I recall, several years ago, we were the worst in the country, one of the only ones that were bumping up at that 20%, and in risk of losing somewhere in the vicinity of $4 to $7 million. Tobacco, I thought it was prevention dollars, so it may not have anything to do with enforcement, but that was a big concern, that we were already not doing a good job preventing smoking among minors and that we were putting ourselves at risk for getting even less federal help to prevent minor smoking.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Kinnegar, a number of years ago, Oregon did indeed face a bad rate, but the last couple of years' reports would show and demonstrate clearly a pretty significant improvement with a compliance rate in the 94% to 95% category.
Okay, and then just one last question. Do you know why it is that we lost the enforcement dollars of 1.5 or whatever it was you said?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kinnegar, no, I don't. My point with that is when you have a state like Idaho receiving four times the amount of enforcement dollars that can be used for enforcement and education that Oregon does, I think we've missed an opportunity, and it's a lost opportunity.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Would you call the next panel, please?
Karen Gerard, Bill Perry, and Stacy Michelson.
We have one more witness, is that right? Who is that, please?
Chris Friend.
Go for it.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. I'm Karen Gerard. I'm the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Prevention Manager with the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here today to speak to Senate Bill 235A and the Indoor Clean Air Act. And in order to be brief, you do have my full written testimony, but I just wanted to speak to Senate Bill 235A does put the definition of enclosed area back into statute. We have heard from advocates, from businesses, and enforcement agencies that the definition has been unclear and a problem. So we have suspended enforcement of that provision of the Indoor Clean Air Act, and we have convened a Rules Advisory Committee meeting where we hope to work through these issues together. And I just want to state that we are very committed to an open and transparent process to work through these complex issues. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Do you support the underlying bill, then?
Chair Greenlick, the underlying bill, there are 8 words that have been problematic for enforcement, and those words are at the end of the clause that say walls that extend from the floor to the ceiling. So without those 8 words, we are very comfortable with this language.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Stacy Michelson with the Association of Oregon Counties. Here today to talk mostly about the Dash 6 amendments proposed to the bill. Those of you who are potentially unfamiliar, your local county boards of commissioners and county courts act as your local board of public health as well. Our members have statutory responsibility as the local public health authority. And so that's why AOC has sort of a vested interest in a lot of this work around tobacco and tobacco prevention. Our folks are the ones who have very clear responsibility to do that work. So we've been following the tobacco retail licensure conversation over the last few years, weighing in at various points. And as previous panelists have mentioned, a number of our counties have considered or are in the process of considering their own local tobacco retail licensure program. For us, the preemption that has been discussed in this bill is a key tenet of any work to be done around tobacco retail licensure, particularly because, you know, we're no longer in an environment where either no counties or only Multnomah County has this in place. We have a number of folks who have actually started rolling this out. Most recently, Klamath just passed a tobacco retail licensure. We've got a few others around the state considering that, both in the metro area and in some of our eastern Oregon areas as well. So I want to point out this isn't just an urban-rural or, west versus east issue. This is something that's coming up all across the state. And it's very important for our members that they have that flexibility at the local level to determine what sort of program works best for them and best fits the needs of their community. So to that point, touching on Mr. Minahan's issue around the fees, that's been left open, to my understanding, in the Dash 6s, because the idea is really that the fees should be set at a level that would simply
cover a local government's expenses to operate such a program. Again, for our folks, as the local board of public health, this is not a money-making mechanism. Public health in general is not much of a money-making mechanism. You know, this is really for our folks about education and prevention around youth use of tobacco and starting that. So a big issue for us has really been around the education portion of any TRL system that's been discussed. And the idea being that, you know, it's hard to set one standard fee across the state. What it costs in Multnomah County will be very different than what it costs in Umatilla County, whether that's a matter of how many retailers exist in the county or an issue of, you know, when you're doing education, are folks driving out? Is it via mail? That's regularly an issue in some of our more rural counties.
Are you supporting the bill?
We are favorable to the Dash 6 amendments. We are neutral on the underlying bill. So I bring that up just to say that we support the open structure around that to give our folks the flexibility to do that work at the local level. And again, to the point that this is really about education, you know, I don't think it's the intent of anyone who's been part of this work that, to Mr. Manahan's example of, you know, if someone leaves and they have a clerk who's a bit harried and, you know, sells to a minor, the idea is not that that's an immediate loss of their license. If there was a discussion where their license happened to be revoked, it's built into that language that there's an appeals process. You know, it's not a one and done, you're out. And I think an example of where the education component could be really useful in all of this, you know, when we could talk about alcohol, servers receive extensive education around how to check IDs, how to look for a fake ID, you know, things like that. I would be welcome to be corrected, but to my knowledge, there's not a similar program or education piece for folks who are selling tobacco products. You know, it's not a requirement that that would happen, but that could be a component of the education that a local might want to include, right? We're going to reach out to folks. Here are some things to look for. Here are some ways that you might tell if someone is a minor. I recently, once again, went through the OLCC training, and, you know, it's not just about the ID, but you know, body language cues to look for, the way that someone's dressing. There's a lot of education around how to tell who you're selling to. So that's an example of one area where, you know, we might be able to do some expansion to that around tobacco work with something like this and giving our folks the flexibility to do that at the local level. And with that, I would just end by saying, you know, Oregon's not in a great place in a lot of our public health work. We've had that conversation repeatedly around public health modernization and the lack of funding that we as a state put in. This would be, cliched as it is, right, another tool in the toolbox for your local boards of public health to do some of this work and to also make those gains at the local level. Because similarly, Oregon is one of a handful of states that doesn't currently have a tobacco retail licensure system in place. So for any TRL system that we may consider, from the perspective of AOC, it would have to include this level of preemption for our folks to be able to do that work locally. Thank you. Great. Happy to answer any questions.
Very good.
Yep. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry of the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association, we're here to support the underlying bill, which is 235A. And just to give you hopefully a brief synopsis of where we got where today, obviously I was here back when we banned smoking in bars years ago, and one of the provisions that we needed in this was this outdoor area. And the reason being is even if we look back today, you look at last year, still the number one complaint that generally the local health officials are getting are people smoking in the street or in the neighborhoods. And so that's what we were trying to prevent with these outdoor enclosed areas, is a way for us to have a situation under our control where we can kind of control those clients. Because when you look at the population of smokers just out after 10:30, it raises way above where normal smoking populations are. And so one of the reasons the definition is written the way it is yes, you have to worry about secondhand smoke, but you also have to worry about the elements. If it does not protect people from the elements, they're not going to go into these structures. You also have to protect from noise in the neighborhoods. That's why the walls are there. And so there are a lot of different factors just besides secondhand smoke that play into the way that this definition was written, because I, as a licensee, if these are my back porch, they're under my control. If they're out on the front sidewalk, they're no longer under my control. And so what we're trying to do is find a way to control these, especially when you're talking about neighborhood bars. How we got in this situation was 2546, which was adding vaping to the Clean Indoor Act, happened last year, and this definition was inadvertently removed. Now, Steiner Hayward, it was her bill when she carried 235 on the floor. She said it was inadvertently removed. I also pulled up the staff measure summaries from 2546. There's no discussion of this happening at all in any of the discussions in the committee last time. So what Steiner Haywood and others did was they took this word for word and reinstated it so it prevented confusion, because these contractors and owners have been working with these definitions for more than 10 years now. So we're trying to make sure that I have an ability to control these populations and try to way to make the Clean Indoor Act work, and so it doesn't create more problems in the neighborhood. And so we're just asking to have this language reinstated so we can basically move forward with something that's been, I think, very effective working in the last 10 to 12 years. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions to this panel? Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Would you call the last witness, please?
Christopher Friend.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, my name is Christopher Friend. I'm the Oregon Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, or ACS-CAN. While we have concerns with the underlying bill, Senate Bill 235, ACS-CAN believes that it's not good public health practice to put definitional language of an enclosed area in statute. As public health evolves, devices and innovation evolve, we think that it's important for OHA to have rulemaking authority around the definition of an enclosed area. ACS-CAN is privileged to participate in the Rules Advisory Committee, currently facilitated by OHA. We believe that all the parties have come together in good faith to find a workable definition for enclosed areas. And additionally, having a privilege of being an organization that spans every state in the nation, I can say that ACS-CAN will only support a definition that includes two walls rather than three, for the purposes of protecting clients, but also allowing the free flow of smoke to prevent secondhand smoking. I think it's important that the committee allow OHA to continue with the Rules Advisory Committee so that all stakeholders are at the table and can come to a workable definition that works for everyone while maintaining the health of workers, hourly wage workers in bars and restaurants. We want to be sure that it's the best definition possible. My organization, like I said, spans every state in the nation, and we see that the best public health definition is one rooted in a definition of two walls rather than three, and does not include temporary walls in that is exclusive of that. Finally, I want to make a mention that ACS-CAN does support the -A6 amendments. We see it as a vital technique to making sure that retailers are playing by the rules, that we're keeping tobacco out of the hands of young people. And without a strong tobacco retail license, I fear that our state is falling behind in protecting our young people. I think the -A6 amendment is absolutely strong because it does not include preemption. It does not disempower local elected officials from doing what's best in their community. Just this year, you've seen a number of local county commissions take action on tobacco control. I believe that local elected leaders are empowered to do this work and should be continued to empower to do this work, and ask that if you are to move this bill, that you amend it to include a definition of two walls rather than three and move it with a -A6 amendment. Thank you.
Are there any questions of this witness? Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 235. We're going to reschedule the two work sessions we didn't get to today. Senate Bill 275A and Senate Bill 367A. We'll reschedule both of them to May 22nd. That's a week from today, I think, right? A week from today. And we'll reschedule the public hearings we had today for a different date once we sort off the calendar and see where it's going. We're about done, I think, with, if I remember, with public hearings. I think we may have a couple more on Wednesday. And from then it'll be all work sessions. Is that, am I remembering correctly?
Work sessions as of Wednesday.
All work sessions, okay. So I think we're done with public hearings. It should make our life a little easier.
Yeah.
Any other comments?
That's it.
Take a look at those bills before Wednesday that we have on the agenda. There'll be a couple of tough ones, I think. We are adjourned.
That's an understatement.
We are adjourned.
That's an understatement.